Welcome to the Eco News Report. We're your hosts, Kurt Cahoon
and David Narum
of Greenway Partners. On today's show, in honor of 420, we will be discussing the environmental impacts of indoor marijuana grows. With all the controversy surrounding marijuana, we will limit our discussion today to the significant environmental impacts of indoor marijuana grows. Joining us today is Peter Allstone, a research engineer at the Schatz Energy Research Center at HSU. Peter has conducted research on energy usage, embodied energy, and has evaluated the energy use of indoor marijuana grows. He also wrote an article in the March 11, 2010 North Coast Journal titled "The Climate Killers Inside." Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter, I've been looking through a New York Times article, and this has become quite the hot topic nationally, talking about some of the statistics regarding this, you know, the $5 billion a year in terms of the revenues from indoor grows, which represent 1% of our national electricity output. Can you shed light on some of the, I guess, the dimensions of this?
Sure. Those are big numbers. And those are coming out of research that was done by Evan Mills, who's a fellow Californian, lives in Mendocino. 1% of electricity use is actually a little bit too high. I think it's more like a third of a percent. But what Evan did was he took estimates of how much marijuana is produced in the whole country and some kind of bottom-up estimates of how much electricity it takes to make it and multiplied the two together to get to 1%.
Well, and, you know, that's revising a little bit from 1% downwards. I guess the number is somewhat in debate still, but let's use the 1% number since it's out there. And 1% seems to be an enormous amount of energy. And in fact, some of our research indicates that basically about half of the energy used by the Defense Department annually.
That sounds about right.
And that is an absolutely staggering number to think about. If you imagine all of the things and activities and wars and petroleum and electricity that's being used to keep armies going and two wars simultaneously, plus the Pentagon, and basically we're using almost half that much energy to grow indoor marijuana in the United States, that's a staggering number.
Peter, what exactly is involved with an indoor grow? I mean, I understand there's lighting, et cetera, and so forth, but what kind of the other variables went into the calculations?
Well, in addition to lighting, which is an obvious one, you've got to ventilate. There's a lot of heat put off by these lights, so you've got to bring in fresh air to keep it cool enough that the plants don't burn up. In hot climates, you've got to use air conditioning. Then there's a whole range of pumps for hydroponics. Some people even have carbon dioxide generators that they use in their grows to increase the ambient carbon dioxide levels in the room. So they're burning natural gas or have bottled carbon dioxide there. And finally, people are using vehicles to transport marijuana around once it's grown.
Right. You know, and there's a lot of things that we aren't going to discuss today. Some of the medical marijuana benefits of marijuana, those things are for another show entirely. And obviously, we're not going to have anything to do with attacking those. But when you look at the elephant in the room here is that this is an enormous amount of energy being used in a sector of the economy that's largely unregulated, largely untaxed, largely unexamined. What do you think might be possibilities here for changing that?
Well, the first obvious one is to legalize it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did that, you could regulate it, you could tax it, and you could take advantage of professional and commercial industrial scale production. If you look at how the pros do it here locally, if you want to grow flowers, you do it in greenhouses like they do at the Sun Valley Group.
And let me interrupt you for a second, Peter. They're not using, or are they, CO2 lights. They're just using greenhouses. Is that right?
You know, they might use supplemental lighting. I'm not sure. I know that supplemental lighting for the cut flower industry is something that does get used.
Okay.
You know, when I did a little back of the envelope and figured out that if you look at how much electricity it takes to do an indoor grow, and you said, all right, I want to grow just as much marijuana, but I want to use the sun. In addition to having supplemental lighting, even in Arcata, where it's not that sunny, you could cut your electric bill by about 60%. And in places like Garberville, you could cut it by 80%.
Wow. That's significant.
So, you know, the indoor growers are using more light than they would otherwise get from the sun, but not that much more.
Peter, I have a question for you. One of the concepts that is kind of getting a little more mainstream, I think, in when people discuss energy is this idea of embedded energy. And, you know, when you look at a car, you buy a new car, well, there was a lot of energy that went into making that car. So that's a concept that can be applied to marijuana. And I think that's kind of the way it has been applied. But before we talk about sort of the embedded energy in a single joint or something like a bag, a pound of marijuana. There's also something that I don't know that if it was measured directly in Evan Mills' study is the other inputs such as fertilizer, water, the equipment, the building materials that you might have. All of those have an additional energy impacts which aren't accounted for in this analysis. Isn't that right?
That's true. Yeah, his analysis stopped at energy that's purchased directly, like electricity and natural gas and gasoline. So all the electricity that it took to make the electric lights is more. And, you know, the trouble with embedded energy calculations is it gets hard to know where to draw the line.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's somewhere. That's where you draw it.
Well, a lot of the fertilizers, especially if they're synthetics, are derived from natural gas. And, you know, this is not a global, well, I mean, I guess it is in a sense, but synthetic fertilizer globally is becoming more expensive as natural gas becomes more expensive. It's sort of the obvious relationship there. And I think that's another kind of connection. Again, where to draw the line is right, but when we use fertilizer, we're basically using energy. We're kind of compounding the effects.
Well, before you guys run away and geek the show out too much, I want to back up for our listening audience.
Back, Kirk.
Yeah, we're going to geek out a little bit here, but we want to get back to the basics here. Let's talk about basically how do you evaluate energy use in any sector? Let's leave marijuana out for a minute, but how do you go actually evaluate energy use?
Well, you know, there are kind of two ways to do it. People talk about bottom-up and top-down.
Okay.
So a bottom-up estimate just means looking at the kinds of equipment and technology that are used in that sector and thinking about how many cars there are and how many miles they're driving and, you know, doing the math that way. A top-down estimate says how many total gallons of gasoline were sold, and you look at it, you know, from the top down.
Okay, now is there a way to assess these when we say one is more accurate and one is more of a generalized survey of energy use?
You know, they're both good for different things.
Okay.
The top-down estimate really captures everything, but it's not very precise. You can't tell exactly where all the gallons of gas went or where all the electrons went in the electric circuit. So the bottom-up estimate shows you where the opportunities are for savings.
Okay.
The top-down estimate, I think, is nicer for getting a real picture of what the total energy is.
Well, and why don't you give us an example of what would you use the bottom-up approach for? Or the top-down. We'll let you start wherever you want.
Okay. Well, I can, for indoor cannabis, the study that Dr. Mills did, mm-hmm. Evan, his was a bottom-up study. He looked at lights and fans and air conditioners, thought about how many hours he thought they were running, mm-hmm. and made a bottom-up estimate of the whole sector. And actually, the study that Dr. Lehman and I did a year ago, we were top-down. We looked at Humboldt County's electric use, purely looked at the single data for each year, and came up with what we thought, how much of that electricity was actually being used for indoor marijuana.
And the statistic, I'm looking at something in front of me that says that in 1996, Humboldt County experienced a 50% rise in per capita residential electricity use. And that's sort of a kind of statistic you're going to get out of a top-down.
It's
sort of generalized across the population. But even so, it tells you that there's a substantial increase going on.
And if you go back to that statistic, Peter, and we ask you kind of a question as an energy researcher, what happened in 1996 that would drive people to suddenly be using 50% more energy?
Well, there's Prop 215,
okay,
and of course, there's also kind of the explosion of the internet.
Okay.
And both those resulted in more energy and more electricity demand. It's hard to tell the difference between them. But what we saw is that energy or electricity use has been going up slowly in the whole state of California and really quickly in Humboldt County. So we said, okay, what's different about Humboldt County from the rest of the state?
Okay.
And that's how it jumped out at us.
And when you're looking at it from that perspective, is there some way that you can say Humboldt County uses more or less energy per capita than the state of California, for example? Are there other places that have an enormous change in their energy, or is it just Humboldt County?
Well, we haven't looked at other counties.
Okay.
You know, this came up in the context of a renewable energy and sustainability study focused on Humboldt County. So We looked at Humboldt, and we looked at the whole state. It's really eye-opening to see how steeply our residential per capita consumption has been increasing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on the tail of that, we have what I know the Schatz Energy Research Center, where you work, is involved in, is the Renewable Energy Secure Communities work where you're trying to determine how much renewable energy actually exists in Humboldt County for us to potentially become exporters of renewable energy and use most or all of our energy in Humboldt County from renewable sources. Where does the growth scene, you know, how does that change that picture? I mean, obviously our demand is going to be much higher. We're going to have to create more renewable sources or other sources to meet it.
That's exactly right. Right now, as far as I can tell, we're using 10% of all the electricity in the county to grow marijuana.
Wow.
That's not just electricity. That's all of the energy?
No, that's electricity.
It's electricity.
So that's not, but it's still a lot.
That's a lot.
And that's 10 times higher than Evan's estimate for the whole country. Obviously, we've got a bigger business here than the rest of the country.
Yes.
So it's 90 million kilowatt hours, and that costs $35 million for our county to pay for all that electricity. So one way to look at this is that we've got this industry in our county, and it's a big moneymaker for us, but we're sending $35 million a year out of the county to pay for all the electricity that's getting used to drive our economy.
That's quite impressive. Before we get into discussion of some of the alternatives and ways to reduce this kind of energy use, a lot of times when you start geeking out, as Kirk says, it's hard for people that don't typically talk in kilowatt hours and whatever to kind of get their head around some of these numbers. Sometimes comparisons are good.
Sure.
Like, you know, how many millions of households could be powered by this energy that's being used, or in terms of like CO2, you know, what is that? What are some of those comparisons that we might be able to draw?
Just looking at Humboldt County, if you look at the amount of electricity that we think gets used for indoor cannabis, it's enough to power 13,000 households. That's about 20% of the households in Humboldt County.
Wow.
That's an amazing number.
And I'm looking at some numbers for CO2 emissions, carbon emissions. This is another one that's often hard to get your head around, but every time we, unless it's a renewable energy source, of course, or nuclear power to some degree, every time we use electricity, we're producing CO2, which, as we know, is a greenhouse gas, which is leading to some substantial global warming impacts. What's a way to get our head around that? I mean, we burn a ton of gas. We get a gallon of gas. We get 20 pounds of CO2. How do we, you know, how do we calculate this in terms of our electricity use?
You know, I don't have a really good way to describe how much more climate change is going to happen from smoking a joint or even 1 year of marijuana production in Humboldt County. But to me, when I want to think about climate change, I look at what do we think is going to happen if we don't do anything about climate change in Humboldt County. Now, we can't do it alone, but if the whole world just kind of ignores things and things keep going, you know, the summertime temperatures here can be 10 or 15 degrees hotter, which will push the coast redwoods right out of existence. You know, we'll get squeezed on water and our water resources. So I don't have a good answer for what it looks like, you know, if you took how many bags of charcoal, you know, and how heavy they are. But in terms of what it looks like if climate change continues at the pace that it's continuing and we don't do anything, it's pretty stark.
Hmm. And without implicating, I mean, marijuana grows in specifically, I mean, the general issue of energy inefficiency and waste is something that needs to be addressed. And I think maybe we could talk about that generally and then come back to the issue of grows and ways in which people might be able to, if they do continue to grow, to resolve some of their excessive energy use problems.
Yeah, this is a sector where there are big opportunities for energy savings and for reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
There's a lot of low-hanging fruit.
Exactly.
Yeah. As an energy person yourself, so you must look at a situation like this and say, wow, look at all these efficiencies that we could put into the system to change the energy usage. I mean, what are some of the things that right off the top of your head people can do?
Well, number one, put them in the sun.
So that means get them out of the dark and, you know, get them out of the greenhouse and get them outside. Okay.
And I understand that there are security concerns and uniformity of crop concerns that people have, but greenhouses are the way that you grow plants if you've got concerns about security and uniformity.
Right.
Of course, that has to do with our whole legal framework.
Right.
If you're going to stay inside, the best thing is, and now this is way beyond my experience. I don't have any experience growing marijuana inside.
It's okay. We're amongst friends here. We're not going to. Sure. Your parents aren't listening.
Yeah. Did you hear that, Mom and Dad? That said, I mean, using efficient lights is good. And from what I understand, metal halide and high-pressure sodium lights are good grow lights. And also making the best use of that light. So using good reflectors, having reflective surfaces in the room to capture as much light as possible are good things.
What about light-emitting diodes or LED lights? Are those being developed now for use in these kind of operations?
I've seen them advertised, and LEDs certainly have the potential to be better than those metal halide or high-pressure sodium. The thing about LEDs is they're an emerging technology, so there's a big range in quality that you'll get.
Sure.
So depending on if it's a good LED or a bad LED, the worst LEDs are worse than the lights that we have now, and the best ones are better.
Right.
And it's really hard for somebody off the street to tell.
And I know there are going to be a lot of people out there that are, of course, growing indoor marijuana that do feel like they wish there was something more they can do. And I think what happened when you saw people switching from incandescent light bulbs to compact fluorescents, and now LEDs are becoming more used in the residential energy sector. But there's almost this generational switchover. It takes years for people to adopt a new technology, doesn't it?
It sure seems that way. And with the incandescent light bulbs, we're at the risk of walking backwards on a national level on that.
Right.
There's certainly been a lot of noise coming from some of the Tea Partiers about wanting to hold on to their incandescent light bulbs.
Yeah, it's a communist conspiracy to take your light bulbs from you folks. That's really what we're all about here.
Well, in addition to the lighting, there's other, there's efficiencies in the other equipment that you mentioned. The ventilation, I imagine, has probably some significant efficiencies that are available. But one of the other things, and some people might say, well, how about powering it with solar panels on your roof? But this becomes a difficult issue when you have such excessive amounts of energy use, doesn't it?
It's difficult, but I tell you what, when you're paying in the top tier,
exactly.
When you pay for electricity in your house, you pay a small amount for the first couple kilowatt hours, and the more you use, the more you pay for each additional kilowatt hour. So if you're growing marijuana inside, you're paying a lot. So those solar modules that you put on the roof end up getting paid for pretty quickly, even though they're probably not going to offset all of the electricity use. It's just a space issue. If you fill the house with marijuana and you fill the roof with solar modules, the math just doesn't work out. You can't make enough electricity to have all the light that you need on your plants.
Yeah, this seems to be one of those wicked problems that exist out there in natural resources and energy uses, where the problem is not just an energy problem, it's also a political problem, and it's a social problem, and there's really no clean, clear way to solve it. So in the situation like indoor marijuana, there may be challenges with the legal system. Trying to change people's access to marijuana medically is going to be a big problem for a lot of people that are sick. They need their medicine, and that's obvious. But how do you as a researcher evaluate making a policy recommendation? It's really what you guys hope to do in some ways, I imagine, with your work, is to influence policy on some level.
Well, I also sit on the Arcata Energy Committee, and we've looked at policies that the city of Arcata could use to try and discourage indoor marijuana growing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those ideas is to have a utility surcharge on really high energy use,
okay,
where people would pay 5 cents or 10 cents more per kilowatt hour when they're using a lot. The trouble with that is that they tried the same thing down in Shelter Cove.
Mm-hmm.
They shifted their top tier to $1 a kilowatt hour, which is about 2.5 times what we pay now in PG&E's territory. The growers there figured out that they just needed to grow a little bit more marijuana in order to cover their new utility bills.
created a perverse incentive, really.
Right. The reason they did it is because their transformer was overloaded. They needed to raise money to buy a new transformer, and they succeeded at that. They raised a lot of money. They put in a new transformer, and now everybody's got a nice, reliable supply of electricity.
Oh, and then the transformer that they just replaced is going to be obsolete in 6 months.
Yeah, it might be.
Even more. Well, and you brought up an interesting point, and many residents of Arcata might remember in the very recent past the whole town being shut down for at least part of a day while a PG&E substation was rebuilt and fuses were assembled. And I know they've been working on a substation down below 7th Street in Arcata near downtown for quite a long time, and I imagine that some of the upgrades PG&E is doing in this area have something to do with the amount of energy we're using from indoor marijuana.
Yeah, I mean, those transmission upgrades are directly related to growing electricity loads. So the load's growing. We think it's growing from indoor marijuana. A equals B equals C.
Right.
Kind of connect the dots there.
Okay. Wow, that is really interesting.
So are there privacy, I'm just thinking about billing data and how you identify high-use homes and, you know, what that might mean, of course, if you look at the data. And are there any privacy issues that if you come across maybe in your research trying to get at data to use?
Oh, we can't even touch the household-level data. Those are completely confidential.
Mm-hmm.
We get kind of aggregate town or county-level data. So they might tell us how many customers fell into each tier of use, but we don't know anything about the individual customer.
Okay.
Well, and there seems to be a widespread perception that PG&E is happier when people are, you know, spending more money on energy. Obviously, they make more. But talk about a little bit about fee structuring and the way that the Public Utilities Commission has set up utilities in the state. They don't necessarily make more money when people have a lot of indoor grows. I mean, can you kind of clarify that for us?
Oh, sure. PG&E basically gets a fixed profit that's set, a profit target from the California Public Utilities Commission. So if they collect too much money this year, then that'll be adjusted later. I guess that's the best way I can explain it.
Okay, so the profit is set on each kilowatt hour that they sell, and if more kilowatt hours are sold, they just make the same level of profit, but they still have some of the same fixed costs.
Right. It's basically like that.
Okay. Okay.
That I don't even quite understand. There are so many lawyers involved with engineers and with politicians that it all gets pretty fuzzy.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a very scary party to be a part of.
Yeah.
Engineers, lawyers, and lawyers all in one room together.
You never know what's going to come out of that. So one of the things that we see in sort of the green building movement is this move, it's not new actually, towards rating systems such as the LEED, you know, on construction, how green is your residential or commercial construction. That's primarily commercial. But in terms of, you know, taking this one step further, say, you know, I know that when we've talked about marijuana legalization, the issue has come up, well, how does Humboldt stand in that situation if we have commercial grows in the Central Valley, which are, you know, taking over the market and we don't have that income anymore? Well, maybe we become a niche market and we brand ourselves as, you know, the organic alternative. But this whole branding idea or independent certification, even product labeling, is this something that you researchers at the Schatz Lab have explored or discussed at all as sort of an incentive?
No, we really haven't. And, you know, to be clear, the extent to which the Schatz Lab has kind of investigated this is pretty minimal. We kind of identified, okay, there's this extra electricity use, and we think it's from this, but we don't want to get into the business of trying to come up with marijuana policy for Humboldt County's future. We're not the right organization to do that, and there are obvious reputational risks if we
No, but you do have to be abreast of the, you know, the energy use. I mean, one of the things that I think is so valuable about the Schatz Lab is your very clear documentation of the energy resources and sort of the trending out. What are we going to need? Where is it going to come from? What are our alternatives? You know, not just given the conventional fossil fuels, but what are our alternatives in renewable energy and how much can we expect to get from energy efficiency? And, you know, this stunning rise in electricity use as a result of these indoor grows, I think, is something that's alarming, and clearly it's wise to be on top of it.
Yeah, you know, on a personal level, I kind of feel like I don't see how you have a Humboldt County brand that's an indoor brand, because a Humboldt County bedroom isn't that different from a bedroom in Fresno or Los Angeles. The brand to me is Humboldt County Outdoor. You know, you think about a field of marijuana surrounded by redwood trees. That's something that you can market around. But it's hard to imagine marketing some guy's bedroom or, you know, somebody's garage.
That's funny. That's really a good image.
That's niche marketing.
That is. Peter, real quick, we focused almost the entire show on energy use and the implications of energy use on indoor for marijuana, but I want to touch just briefly on some other areas that we've come across in these issues in indoor marijuana. Water pollution. There's a ton of water that comes out of these facilities laden with pesticides, fungicides, mildicides, you know, rodenticides. There's a lot of issues that have environmental implications other than energy. I mean, as David mentioned earlier, the use of fertilizers, depending on where fertilizers are sourced, there's an enormous amount of energy that's used to create those fertilizers in many cases. So from an environmental perspective, why does energy use matter? Why is that an important thing for us to consider as an environmental concern?
Well, for me, it comes down to climate change is one of the biggest concerns. You know, so when you use energy, when you're emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and I discussed how that can have impacts on our California local environment and our Humboldt County environment, there are also going to be energy impacts in terms of local pollution from the plants. There are fish kills from hydroelectricity. The list goes on.
And, you know, one other thing that we're forgetting, of course, is where the fuel is sourced. You know, natural gas is drilled, and it has enormous environmental implications in many places where it's drilled. Coal, obviously, with mountain-type removal, coal mines, all the things that come along. Aside from the climate reasons and the climate implications of burning those fossil fuels, there's all kinds of issues that have concerns regarding the environment.
Yeah, there was an amazing study that was written up in the New York Times, I think just last week, on unconventional natural gas, where these are guys from Cornell, they estimated that the greenhouse gas from unconventional, so this is fracked natural gas, is as bad as coal, or maybe even two times as bad as coal.
Wow. So this natural gas that's being touted as a clean fuel is actually, when it's fracked at least, is coming to us in a very dirty form.
Exactly. And it's related to how much methane leaks during the fracking process.
Right. You
know, methane's a really strong greenhouse gas compared to carbon dioxide.
Right. Much more significant. Well, you know, real briefly, I want to touch on another issue with the geography of indoor grows. North County indoor grows tend to happen in houses, rental houses, or bedrooms, or maybe the occasional commercial building. And it seems like in the South County, in the more rural areas of Humboldt, Mendocino, and Trinity counties, you might have on somebody's 25 acres, you might have an old barn or a warehouse or a garage that's actually being powered by a diesel generator that's running 24 hours a day for months on end. The diesel coming out of that generator is obviously going to have much lower emissions controls than that coming out of a power plant. And let alone all the diesel that could be potentially spilled in the creeks and rivers and the ground in those areas. And I know there's been a number of big spills down in southern Humboldt. So I'm wondering if you have any familiarity with that issue.
I've certainly been reading the paper about it and kind of seeing the pictures of red diesel flowing in the creeks. It's not a good image. I don't have any particular expertise, though, on that.
Well, you know, we've probably done a good job of harshing people's mellows today, a little bit at
least.
We're
trying to be blunt.
Yeah.
Oh.
But it is a burning issue, so we are hoping
just a little corny humor at the end of the show.
Well, you know, one of the other things I think we need to talk about, and I think this has raised the ire of a lot of people in Arcata in particular, and I say that as an Arcata resident, is just the fact that, you know, there's a lot of destruction of the homes in which these grows are going on. I mean, I know this isn't exactly an issue related to the Schatz lab, but, I mean, this is related, and it's the possibility of electrical fires from some of the wiring, right?
Yeah, there's a danger there. If you've got thousands of watts of lights, it's hot and it just dries out the structure. It turns it into firewood. That combined with amateur wiring, put it that way, is a good recipe for house fires.
Hmm.
The flip side can also happen. If people don't ventilate properly, they get moisture buildup. You're growing plants. This is a big agricultural operation. There's a lot of water. And mold and mildew can be a big problem for homes where this happens, to the point where the structures can just be condemned.
Exactly. Recently happened, I believe.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Our guest today has been Peter Allstone of the Schatz Energy Research Center, and we've been talking today about the environmental implications of indoor marijuana grows. Well, EcoNews listeners, we also want to remind you that this Friday, the 22nd, is Earth Day Bash, put on by Humboldt Baykeeper, featuring The Devil Makes Three. The dinner is at 6 o'clock, and music starts at 7:30. That's located at the Arcata Community Center this Friday at 6 p.m., again, supporting Humboldt Baykeeper on Earth Day. You've been listening to the EcoNews Report. We are your hosts, Kirk Cahoon
and David Narum
of Greenway Partners. We are speaking today with Peter Allstone of the Schatz Energy Research Center. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Thanks to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU.